Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. Before we get into this month's Lungcast interview, I would like to introduce a new segment. Each month, we will take the opportunity to highlight important milestones and events in the history of cardiopulmonary medicine and shine a light on important personalities that have contributed to the field over the years. Since this is airing in February, Black History Month, I wanted to use this introductory segment to speak about Dr. Vivian Theodore Thomas, who was born in Louisiana in 1910 as the grandson of a slave. He attended high school in Nashville and graduated with honors in 1929. In the wake of the stock market crash in October, he secured a job as a laboratory assistant in 1930 with Dr. Alfred Blalock at Vanderbilt University. Tutored in anatomy and physiology by Blalock, Thomas rapidly mastered complex surgical techniques and research methodology. In an era when institutional racism was the norm, he was classified and paid as a janitor, despite the fact that by the mid-1930s, he was doing the work of a postdoctoral researcher in Blalock's lab. As a result, Blalock and Thomas began experimental work in vascular and cardiac surgery, defying medical taboos against operating upon the heart. By 1940, the work Blalock had done with Thomas placed him at the forefront of American surgery, and when he was offered the position of chief of surgery at his alma mater, Johns Hopkins, in 1941, he requested that Thomas accompany him. While there, in 1943, Blalock was approached by renowned pediatric cardiologist Dr. Helen Taussig, who was seeking a surgical solution to a complex and fatal four-part heart anomaly called tetralogy of Fallot, also known as Blue Baby Syndrome. Thomas was charged with the task of first creating a blue baby-like condition in a dog, then correcting the condition by means of the pulmonary to subclavian anastomosis. In nearly 2 years of laboratory work involving some 200 dogs, he demonstrated that the corrective procedure was not lethal, thus persuading Blalock that the operation could be safely attempted on a human patient. During that first procedure in 1944, Thomas stood on a step stool behind Blalock, coaching him through the procedure. Unfortunately, as a result of institutional racism, when the procedure was published in the May 1945 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, Blalock and Taussig received sole credit for the Blalock-Taussig shunt. In the article and in Blalock's writings, he was never credited for his role. To the host of young surgeons Thomas trained during the 1940s, he became a figure of legend, the model of the dexterous and efficient cutting surgeon. The renowned surgeon, Denton Cooley, told Washingtonian Magazine in 1989, "Even if you've never seen surgery before, you could do it because Vivian made it look so simple. There wasn't a false move, not a wasted motion when he operated." Surgeons like Cooley credited Thomas with teaching them the surgical techniques which placed them at the forefront of medicine in the United States. Despite the deep respect Thomas was accorded by these surgeons and by the many black lab technicians he trained at Hopkins, he was not well paid. Eventually, after negotiations on his behalf by Blalock, he became the highest paid technician at Johns Hopkins by 1946, and by far the highest paid African American on the institution's payroll. Blalock's approach to the issue of Thomas's race was complicated and contradictory throughout their 34-year partnership. After Blalock's death, Thomas stayed at Hopkins for 15 more years. In his role as director of surgical research laboratories, he mentored many African-American lab technicians, as well as Hopkins' first black cardiac resident, Dr. Levi Watkins Jr., whom Thomas assisted with his groundbreaking work in the use of the automatic implantable defibrillator. In 1976, Johns Hopkins University presented Thomas with an honorary doctorate. Following his retirement in 1979, Thomas began work on his autobiography. He died on November 26, 1985, at the age of 75, and the book was published just days later. The 2004 HBO television movie, Something the Lord Made, which I would highly recommend, was based on his role in the historic Blue Baby surgery, as was the 2003 public television documentary, Partners of the Heart. In this last month, we surpassed a crucial anniversary from the coronavirus 2019 pandemic. The sharing of the SARS-CoV-2 sequence from Chinese investigators to the rest of the world on January 10th of last year. This action set forth the conceptualization of mRNA vaccines, including Moderna's own product, in the same week. These vaccines were developed and assessed in the coming months, and now a year later, they are being distributed by the millions worldwide. In a year fighting to control and lessen the harm of the pandemic virus, we've learned much in treating coronavirus and in refining the production and distribution of evidenced vaccines. But we've also encountered familiar public health hurdles. Vaccine literacy and acceptance, even among a public greatly affected by COVID-19, remains limited. For as crucial as it is for the medical community to continually evolve understanding of virus mutations, spread, treatment, and prevention, it is equally important for it to adjust its messaging and outreach to at-risk communities. And with today marking the beginning of Black History Month, it is also important to stress the disparities occurring in the pandemic on minority communities in the United States, an effect which requires tailored, empathetic outreach as vaccines become more widely available. It helps to have experts who can walk the line between research and public health messaging, and our guest today certainly fits the bill. This month's episode features our discussion with Dr. Alcindor of Meharry Medical College and Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, a renowned virologist and immunologist, a leader of medical community outreach strategies, and a frequent collaborator on both fronts with the American Lung Association. Dr. Donald Alcindor is associate professor at the Center for AIDS Health Disparities Research, Division of Microbiology and Immunology, Physiology, and Obstetrics and Gynecology at Meharry Medical College, and joins us for a discussion on the adaptive immune system, the virus spike protein, evolving COVID-19 therapies and vaccines, and the keys to reaching at-risk minority groups with vaccine information and resources. We hope you enjoy. So, Dr. Alcindor, before we get into the specifics of COVID-19, can you give our listeners a primer on the body's adaptive immune system and its role in fighting viral infections in general?
Yeah, so the immune system monitors the body for microbes such as SARS-CoV-2 all the time. And the idea is that you have the innate immune system that protects you at the front level, meaning that your skin, certain things, epidermis and so forth. But again, the real players in being able to prevent you from getting a virus infection would be the humoral response. That means the B cells that differentiate into antibody producing cells called plasma cells are very important. However, they're intertwined because the cell-mediated immune response that include T-cell functions, they also provide B-cells what they need in terms of soluble factors, that is chemokines, that allows them to go through a terminally differentiation process to make these antibodies. And of course, there's antigen-presenting cells that present process antigen in virus-infected cells to the immune system in the context of major histocompatibility proteins that allow these memory cells to develop at the same time to direct cytotoxic T cells to establish viral clearance. And so they work interdependent of each other. And together, they are very important in terms of protecting you long-term from virus infection. The B cells, particularly making antibodies, in this case, neutralizing antibodies that would prevent virus entry, as well as memory T cells that sit and wait until you get a natural infection, and they come into play relatively quickly. And that's why we normally would get a boost infection or a second injection. The idea is to rev up our memory T cell population so that they sit and wait and be able to come in and basically initiate a robust immune response when triggered by a natural occurring infection.
Great, that's a great start. Both graphically with the multiple images of the coronavirus and articles and on websites, almost every media outlet has the picture. There's the portrayal of the important spike protein. Now, before we start talking about the role of this protein in vaccines, can you describe, and I think you touched on a little bit, from an immunologic standpoint, what has been occurring in this disease process as a result of this spike protein attaching to the ACE2 or angiocondensate-converting enzyme 2 receptor in our airways and elsewhere in the body?
So the ACE2 receptors is everywhere. I mean, you have ACE2 receptors from the eye to the testes to the veins and arteries and so forth. It's everywhere. And the possibility of infection is systemic when you think about this virus. So this all is governed by a naturally occurring receptor that has a normal function in blood pressure control. And it is associated with controlling and regulating the aldosterone system in blood pressure control. So the ACE2 receptor being in particular in your T-zone, that is your eyes, nose, and mouth, where you are more likely to come in contact with infection via a cough, a sneeze, or a series of conversations with a person where a virus can be transmitted. So in this case, there is a binding of the ACE protein receptor on a target cell with the spike protein on the outside of the virus. I want to say that the spike protein is a glycoprotein that is encoded by the viral genome. It is not from the cell. That makes it very specific. The spike protein is also important to everybody that is trying to make a vaccine because it has been identified as, of course, that protein from the virus that facilitates virus entry into a permissive cell. Now, it also has one other function, and that is, it is the target antigen on the virus that represent the antigen where you can develop neutralizing antibodies to. And so back as far as January, the spike protein sequence was delivered to us from China to allow us to start to developing antivirals to this particular virus. Now, the idea is that the spike protein sequences from one coronavirus to another vary. The spike protein also is responsible for entry in a sense where you also, in order to enter into a cell by this coronavirus, you need two things to happen. You need binding of the spike protein, and the spike protein has both an S1 and an S2 domain. There also has to be cleavage of the spike protein at the S1 and S2 interface by a serine protease from the cell that allows fusion of the viral envelope with the cell membrane. And then the virus now carried into the cell by receptor-mediated endocytosis. Now, once the virus is inside the cell, it's in an endosome. The endosome undergoes acidification. This acidification causes destabilization in the viral capsid proteins, releasing the viral RNA into the cytoplasm. And now, once the viral RNA is in the cytoplasm, because it's a plus strand RNA, meaning that the RNA genome of the coronavirus serves as messenger RNA directly and can be directly translated into a polyprotein that jump starts the virus infection. The coronavirus is because of this property, being a plus strand RNA genome, it is basically faster in terms of its ability to replicate. This virus never has to visit the nucleus as part of its replication cycle.
Very good. You've given us a great picture of what's going on in our bodies when this virus attaches there and infects us. And I think that leads to my next question. In the past year, we've certainly had the change in treatment for COVID-19, and it's evolved. And now we're armed with some therapeutics that are antiviral, such as remdesivir. We have drugs that harness the aspects of the body's immune responses, such as tocilizumab, and a new role for dexamethasone has been found. And we also have drugs that enhance our ability to fight the virus early on. These include the monoclonal antibodies, the cocktails from Regeneron and Lilly. I think you've touched on it already, but how are these drugs playing a role in what our body is doing to fight this infection once it's triggered by that virus getting into our cells?
So many of these drugs, it's part of timing as well, meaning that or if you have a situation where you have severe lung disease, many of these reagents will simply not work. Meaning that if you have an antiviral that is developed to prevent virus replication, and the virus now is basically has caused the cytokine storm, the patient is undergoing mechanical ventilation, virus replication is not your issue anymore. The lung damage now is severe, meaning that the virus has done its job already by turning on a cytokine storm and causing so much damage of lung alveoli that oxygen exchange now is compromised in the way. So some of these technologies in terms of antivirals and these humanized monoclonal antibodies will work, but they will work very early in the course of infections, meaning that they are designed to prevent virus replication. But when virus replication is no longer part of the most immediate pathology, then some of these reagents will not be useful, meaning that you are trying to prevent the virus from getting to the point where it's in the lower airway and it has established the kind of pathology that puts the patient at most severe, in the most severe course of the disease. And so when you think about monoclonal antibodies and you think about the president getting those treatments, he got those treatments very early, and they are very effective in the early phase where you have, where you're trying to reduce the amount of virus in the system and to prevent the most severe course of the disease. So a timing is very important. And again, dexamethasone is very, very useful as a cheap alternative to turn down this cytokine storm, to allow this virus to not really cause the kind of damage in the lung that you would expect, that's very difficult to recover. Because once those patients get into a condition to where they have ARDS, or in terms of respiratory distress, then this is nearing a type of lung failure. This becomes critical.
Right. And I have personally, with my patients, I've seen many of them benefit from the timing that you talked about, getting these, some of these drugs early on. And the monoclonal antibodies seem to be making a difference as well. I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Fauci last summer, and he thought that the monoclonal antibodies would work well hand in hand with the vaccines. And I think we're starting to see that being mentioned in the newspapers now by Lilly and Regeneron. So
absolutely. And I think with the monoclonal antibodies, being able to get a person into the emergency room at the early stage of disease is critical. Because this virus causes a silent hypoxia that can fool you, actually, making you think that you're not really sick. But again, it can come on really fast and take you to a place you don't want to be.
Yeah, the monoclonal antibodies, I think, are making a difference as far as trying to keep people out of the hospital during these surges. And the more of those we use, unfortunately, what we're hearing is that many times to administer these antibodies requires an infusion center, requires additional staffing, and sometimes these monoclonal antibodies are sitting on the shelf because people don't have time to administer them, which, again, a logistical issue.
I want to also say for my colleagues at Vanderbilt, I am working with them on a program called Pass It On, which is a trial that's looking at convalescent plasma as a very effective intervention COVID-19 disease that's been hospitalized. And so this is a very important trial as well, because convalescent plasma has had a long history of being successful for some of the other infections that have emerging infections like Ebola and so forth. We expect that it will play a role here with COVID-19. We need the clinical data to support that role.
So I wanted to switch gears just a little bit. You've already mentioned antibodies a few times, and we know that these are in response to a viral infection and a response to vaccines, hopefully, that are effective. But we also know there's some uncertainty of the lasting immunity to the virus based on either a natural infection or a response to the vaccine. And for this reason, do you think there's going to be a role for routine testing of antibody levels in the population at any point in time going forward?
So I want to say something that's a little bit out of context here, but I want to talk about the different coronaviruses that we have. There's seven different coronaviruses that infect humans. There's four of them that has been circulating in our population since the 1960s. These are the commonly circulating coronaviruses that infect particularly young children over and over. A study done in New York City and Columbia suggested that children become infected routinely with these commonly circulating, and they often will get infected routinely by the same virus, suggesting that these commonly circulating coronaviruses provide very little immune duration. Now, we hope that that's not the case with the vaccines, because that would be problematic. There is studies that are starting to show that a vaccine, Pfizer vaccine or Moderna vaccine, is likely to give you 6 months to a year protection. It's very important that we know that. However, it will take time for us to know that for sure. It turns out that about 10% of people that get the Moderna vaccine don't make neutralizing antibodies at all. And so what I'm saying is that this will be different for different people. We know that people that are older than 65 will have trouble making a robust antibody response in some cases because of immune senescence in those populations. We know that children are not likely to have severe bouts of this coronavirus for a couple reasons. And that is, children get vaccines all the time in school. They are being infected all the time when they interact with other children. Their immune systems are continually being primed all the time. And the idea is that children have a remarkable ability to regenerate alveolar epithelium. And those, and again, children are not walking around with comorbidities. And so when you put that all together, children are less likely to get a disease that is severe due to the coronavirus. However, when you look at children that have underlying clinical conditions, these children have to be monitored very carefully. I think there will be a place for antigen testing in the future. First of all, you have to do antigen testing to look at the level of neutralizing antibody on a population level scale. That's very important, because what it allows you to do is be able to say, in this particular community, we see neutralizing antibody protection at a low level that we should be concerned about. Because what we know is that there will be some people that will say, I am not interested in this vaccine at all. Or you'll have anti-vaxxers or people that have religious reasons about a vaccine. We need to be able to identify these high-risk populations that might represent reservoirs for this virus in the future after people get vaccines on a large scale. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And of course, we have to also consider this. All of the vaccines that currently exist does not take into account that have an indication for children. It turns out about a quarter of our population is younger than 18 years old. We have to recognize this population, meaning that the vaccines that we have right now, Pfizer is the only vaccine that has 16 and older as an indication for administration. A lot of the companies now are looking at young people, but that won't come online for some time. If we're looking to make go back to normalcy, where children are going back to school, we have to have an answer. We have to have a very important answer in terms of the likelihood of transmission when they're at school and when they come back. We have to make a plan to vaccinate these children by getting younger people into clinical trials. And of course, until that happens, we may need a situation where children are advised to do routine antigen testing at home before they go to school. And you have to have a way of being able to test children at school on a routine basis, meaning that you have to have a baseline of infection in your school that can change at any time, depending upon a child, the number of children coming in infected.
Now, I think you're absolutely right. And I know certain school districts across the country have instituted fairly regular testing, as have many college campuses for that reason. But before I move on from this topic, you mentioned the antibodies, and those can be measured and if it makes a difference. But you also mentioned earlier on that we have the T cells that provide some memory.
Right.
But as far as I know, is there any good way of measuring that memory?
So the idea is that the way you do in the laboratory is that you isolate peripheral blood. Then you isolate T cells from peripheral blood. And then you can subsequently isolate cytotoxic T cells or T helper cells. And then you can basically screen virus-infected cells for the ability of these T cells to kill them. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And that would give you a measure of your cytotoxic T cell population within a global T cell population in peripheral blood. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. But again, that's not something that's clinically readily done.
The idea is that to do that on a large scale would simply cost and take a lot of people power.
Right. Okay. Very good. Wanted to touch a little bit on the fact that recently we've seen in the newspapers that the World Health Organization sent an expedition to China to study the origin of the SARS-CoV-2.
Yes.
And my understanding is that this is important on a couple levels. Finding the source might allow us to prevent it from reintroducing it into humans. We may be learning how to had jumped from bats into humans, and maybe we can even learn more about it to help from a therapeutic standpoint. Based on your experience in virology particularly, Can you comment on these kind of task forces that go looking for the origins and what you expect might come out of this?
Yeah, I think it's very important because as we talked this morning, the intermediate zoological host for SARS-CoV-2 is unknown. Everybody thought it was the pangolin, but it's not. Looking at the sequence data, looking at genetic profiles in the different animals, we are still on the hunt to find the true zoological intermediate host for SARS-CoV-2. And I think this is going to be very important. This is as important as being able to do genetic screening of people that become infected with SARS-CoV-2. Currently in the United States, we are doing genetic screening of 0.3% of those people that are getting infected. Ideally, we would have to be doing 5% screening of the infected population to basically understand the genetic variability of this virus over time. Now, we know that this is a zoological transmission, what we call zoonosis. We have to understand how this virus is being transmitted in the animals that serve as reservoirs. The idea is that, and again, once we do, we have to somehow limit the contact of this zoological host to humans. Or for that matter, we've seen it many times in the past where the animals become vaccinated against virus that they can transmit to humans. Why not do that? If you're able to identify a zoological host, why don't you vaccinate the animals, particularly if these animals are animals that are needed in the population, vaccinate them against diseases that they can transmit to us. And of course, being able to monitor this virus as it moves from one host to the other, because this virus, we know very clearly, can propagate itself in a number of different animal species. And the idea of being able to monitor this over time will allow us to answer the question, what is coming next, how soon it will be here, and how are we prepared to deal with it? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think this leads into my next question that has to do with the fact that throughout the world, we're recognizing mutations or variants in SARS-CoV-2 virus. And I understand mutations are not unusual in RNA viruses, but the recent recognition of these viruses has brought up a lot of questions. Are the vaccines going to remain effective? And also comment on how the variant is described as being more easily transmitted. I know an R factor is a term used in epidemiology, immunology for contagion. Can you discuss this concept with our listeners and how it's going to affect what we do going forward?
So the idea is that the SARS-CoV-2 virus does not mutate more than the garden variety RNA virus. And then when you say mutation, you want to be specific in terms of where this mutation occurs. A mutation usually in viruses represent a silent mutation. And when I say a silent mutation, meaning that the change comes at a level where there's no change in the virus's ability to enter a cell, to spread, and to cause and to be more virulent, meaning causes more severe disease. You see what I'm saying? And so the idea is that when we're talking about mutation, we're talking about a mutation in the proteins that govern virus entry into target cells. In this case, we're specifically focusing on the spike protein. Now, so the mutations that we see coming out of the UK will likely be a mutation that is considered less serious than the South African mutation. The South African mutation, after screening, what they've seen is that there is mutations in the spike protein domain that after doing laboratory tests with convalescent serum and antibodies from patients that have recovered, that it is less protective of cells infected in culture. You see what I'm saying? Meaning that the efficacy of the vaccine, that is the neutralizing antibodies generated for the vaccine, will it provide you with the level of protection that you've seen in clinical trials when you're infected with this variant? And that becomes the question that we have today. And so the idea is that because you can study this in a laboratory relatively quickly, they have been able to show at Fred Hutchinson that this variant, the South African variant, seems to be a little more infectious compared using the antibodies to protect compared to the other strains that have been here before. The concern now is what is the level of penetrance of this South African strain into the U.S. population. What we know is that it's simply a matter of time. Now, I just want to say that when a person gets infected with a virus, the virus goes through a natural mutation process, okay? When you think about DNA, mutations in DNA are taken care of by a proofreading function that goes back and makes the mistake correct. With these RNA viruses, they do not have a proofreading function. And so those mutations are permanent. And so if you have the right mutation in the right place, and that the neutralizing antibodies are not able to affect that virus with that change in that particular antigen, you could have a situation where the level of protection with the existing antibodies that you likely develop from a vaccine may be less efficacious than with the original strain that the vaccine was made to. Does that make sense?
It does. And do you think with this recent concern, is this going to be, are going to be vaccine candidates being developed against this particular variant?
So this is something very interesting. And the vaccine companies had this in mind when they developed this strategy. So the platforms that the RNA vaccines are made from, are made on, are synthetic platforms, meaning that the RNA molecules are made synthetically. When they want to make a change, they simply can go in and make that change and have another vaccine candidate ready to go within a matter of weeks. And so that synthetic platform that is modular, meaning that you can go in and make ready changes to the vaccine as the variants might force it to do, then that becomes something they can easily deal with. Now, if you're using a whole virus, or for that matter, a virus that is delivered where you have a spike protein delivered by an adenovirus, basically a replication defective adenovirus, this becomes more problematic. And so the idea is with an RNA platform, you can easily make changes that can go into a new vaccine that can be encapsulated into a lipid nanoparticle, and now you've got a new vaccine. And again, we don't know in the future, and we will require a vaccine cocktail to deal with this virus, right? Meaning that we have multiple variants in the population that will require a cocktail of RNA molecules to deal with. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think you've kind of touched on what my next set of questions had to do with, knowing that we have two vaccines already with emergency use authorization. And I believe most likely AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson will be some of the next ones. Yeah. And I know there's slight variations. You mentioned RNA, mRNA, and you mentioned viral vectors. Can you just touch on again those differences and how these four companies may be a little bit different? And I know that Johnson & Johnson's DNA versus RNA.
Yeah. And so the idea is that you have two RNA vaccine platforms in the form of Pfizer and Moderna. You have some storage issues. And again, it has to do with the experiences of the companies. So Pfizer has tall shoulders to stand on. They are a long existing company. However, Moderna is a very small company that found its way into this fray by their work on Ebola in the past. And turns out Moderna has never delivered in its history of existence an FDA-approved vaccine. This would be the first for them. And of course, the money that was put out by Project Warp Speed basically changed the dynamics of this small company into a powerhouse where it sits today. And so you're looking at a company whose profit margins went up 3,000% during this time and so forth. So Pfizer and Moderna, very similar vaccines in terms of RNA that are encapsulated into lipid nanoparticles. You're also looking at a situation where you have 16 indication for 16 years old versus 18 years old and older for Pfizer versus Moderna respectively. And then you get into the other vaccine. Now, I should say Pfizer and Moderna have been setting the bar for efficacy with 94 and 95%. I mean, we're talking about, this is the level of efficacy you would see with measles virus. You see what I'm saying? Very high. When the FDA is saying that we will take 50% for EUA authorization. So What we're looking for is seeing what efficacy do we see with Johnson & Johnson, what efficacy do we see with AstraZeneca coming out and when they come out of phase three trials. And of course, Novavax is a quiet follower. Novavax is what we're using here at Meharry. We're very proud of that. Novavax will be coming out of phase three clinical trials very soon. This is basically the whole spike protein mixed with an adjuvant and given to a volunteer, which is very different. So Novavax is a purified spike protein given as an adjuvant together to produce antibodies. Now, I want to get into the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. This is a situation where you're taking an adenovirus and you're cloning in the spike protein into the adenovirus after stripping away all of the disease genes that the adenovirus carries. Now, I want to say that we are infected with adenoviruses routinely throughout our lifetime. The adenovirus that they selected was an adenovirus that is somewhat inert when it comes to causing disease. But adenoviruses made a name for themselves when it came to gene therapy. They are very efficient at delivering a gene. And so an adenovirus delivering this spike protein as part of an injection process is something that they're depending on. I also want to say that Johnson & Johnson is very unique as they have a vaccine that's going to be a one-dose vaccine that can be held at refrigerator temperatures for a long period. That gives them an advantage over some of these other vaccine companies. In the case of Pfizer, requiring ultra cold temperatures in the range of minus 80 degrees, minus 70 degrees. And of course, having a one dose refrigerator vaccine is something that's going to be very useful. And the idea is that you're going to see by the summer, maybe a half dozen vaccines with EUA authorization that will be available for protection of individuals in the population. And this is something that should happen, meaning that if these vaccines meet the FDA requirements and are approved for emergency use, then there should be no regard for selecting one vaccine over the other, because that could be problematic. The idea is that you want to select a vaccine that is safe and have shown in clinical trials that it will do what it says and that the side effects are marginal when it comes to side effects. Because adenoviruses notoriously have had side effects when it comes to gene therapy operations in terms of delivering genes.
Very good. Well, I wanted to touch again on the term effectiveness of these vaccines. You mentioned 94-95% for the Pfizer and Moderna. And we're often hearing about the effectiveness is to prevent severe infection. Right. How does this translate into preventing infection completely and also, more importantly, preventing transmission? How's that explained in the science?
So starting with the last thing you said, preventing transmission, that is the most difficult one. The reason being is that the clinical trials were not set up with Pfizer and Moderna to test that, what you're talking about right now. The way to test that you can prevent transmission of getting a vaccine is that what you do is you give your vaccines to people, and when you find out those individuals that had your vaccine were infected, you follow them over time, intermittently, taking nasal swabs and being able to tell over time, do you see a reduction in viral loads or you see no virus in their system? And that strategy, that's a strategy that was taken on by Oxford AstraZeneca in their trial. And so their trial will be able to shed some light on the inability of you to transmit the virus after getting their vaccines. The other companies do not have this caveat in their development of their vaccine plan. And so the other thing is that most of the indications for Pfizer and Moderna is that it will basically take care of severe symptoms in the patients that would get their vaccine. It would more than likely prevent hospitalization. You will still likely be able to transmit this this infection, even if you're asymptomatic. And so I think that's clear going around. Until they do studies that basically look at those people that got the vaccine and intermittently be able to show over time that they show a reduction in virus load, then they can say that their vaccine is able to prevent or reduce transmission.
Absolutely. So it's been a recognized issue that clinical trials to assess new therapeutics for really many diseases often have less than optimal representation by communities of color.
Yeah.
And this includes the recent and ongoing trials for COVID vaccine. Coupled to this is the hesitancy on the part of many people, especially those communities of color, to get the vaccination when it's available. But I understand, as you've mentioned already, Meharry College is involved with the Novavax COVID-19 clinical vaccine. And I believe that puts minority individuals front and center to ensure the vaccine is efficacious for their community, which has been historically underserved. And I believe one of your colleagues, Dr. Rajir Bir Singh, said Black and brown people must be represented rather than overlooked, which is why Meharry is honored to oversee this research and establish best possible outcomes. Can you please comment on this history of inequities and the important advocacy role that I know you've been involved with even before you became part of the American Lung Association's volunteer corps?
Yeah. So what we saw very early on, starting in April, some of the large companies that make reagents for doing biomedical research, they saw that this would be a problem in Black and brown communities. And they felt that the Black and brown communities would have poor access to testing. This was something they wanted to take off the table. And they knew that based upon existing health disparities in Black and brown communities, not having access to available testing would be problematic. And it would slow down the progress and delivery of those vaccines when they become available in those communities. We knew also that these communities had a high level of hesitancy when it came to accepting vaccines. And for a variety of reasons, going back to Tuskegee and all of the things that happened before. But what we're seeing already, looking at Pennsylvania as a state in question here, that we're already seeing whites getting this vaccine at a higher level than minority groups in Pennsylvania right now. And we expect to see this across the board in other states as well. And this is for reasons other than hesitancy. And so we were concerned about that. So what some of the companies decided to do is that they decided to come into Meharry in particular and set up a testing facility at the university, meaning that Meharry would be a place where people in Black and brown communities could come to get routine testing. At the same time, the president here at Meharry, Dr. James E.K. Hildreth, what he did that was very insightful is that early on, Meharry led the way in developing testing centers across Nashville, meaning that people could drive up, get tested and get answers concerning their COVID test within 3 to 5 days. And we have routinely been doing this over time. And again, we also felt that people from underserved communities would simply not have adequate access to testing. We also found that when we look in Latinx communities, we particularly in mixed status household, these were individuals that were concerned about testing because when you go to test, you have to give personal information. And living in mixed status household, these individuals were apprehensive of getting a test. This becomes very important because if you say to yourself, we are going to give this vaccine to all Americans and we're going to leave out immigrants, this is going to be problematic. Everybody that you encounter in the United States, whether they're an immigrant or a citizen, needs to be tested regardless of their status. This is very important. And so I often went, we call it boots on the ground, into minority communities to talk with them directly about how they felt about this vaccine. And let me tell you, I got a mixed response. Now, where I got a positive response, it was where people had a horrifying experience with this virus, meaning that a woman told me that a young grandson that was still going to in-person school came back and delivered that virus to a grandmother upstairs and she passed away. And because of what happened, she was very, very interested in this vaccine as soon as it became available. At the same time, I go down the street about a half mile and walk into a barbershop. And a customer in the barbershop was listening to what I said. And he said to me, why are you coming in here with this poison to kill our people? And so I'm just telling you the two extremes of how people are accepting are resisting this vaccine. Now, there's a whole lot of people that are telling me this. I will take it when I see what happens later on. Then I get this idea that I have never had the flu shot. Why do I need this? And then what I get from young people is that my friend had this and nothing happened to him. And I go and I talk to rural communities. These are people that live in rural communities, and they are telling me that is the general understanding that this is a hoax in the rural community. And this is the way for vaccine companies to make money off of poor people. And the idea is that this is only a variation of the flu, and that it should not get the attention that it's getting. And of course, the anti-vaxxers don't believe in vaccines at all, whether they've proven to be effective and safe. And so I get a myriad of responses from many different members of the community in how they regard this vaccine. I think that's changing, and I'd like to be in the forefront of that change.
Well, Dr. Alcindor, you know, thank you very much. I mean, I've learned a lot today from your discussion of immunology and our immune system. And I believe you're the perfect guest to interview during this time of our pandemic, especially during Black History Month, with views on the immunology of the virus, and importantly, your views on the disparities that have been highlighted by the pandemic, not only related to disease outcomes, but also the cultural issues of vaccine hesitancy and lack of robust inclusion of communities of color in clinical trials. I really want to thank you for what you're doing, both in your work as a virologist and immunologist, and I'm very proud to have you as a volunteer for the American Lung Association for all the work you're doing in the community to help improve the vaccination rate. So thank you again for the time today.
Thank you so much.
I look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Dr. Alcindor for helping lead discussion on so many differing matters of the pandemic and for his frontline work in community outreach. He and his colleagues set the model for public health care, and not only this, but future outbreaks. And thanks to all of you for joining our conversation this month. We've begun to reach one-year marks in the early outbreak of COVID-19, and hopefully this talk with Dr. Alcindor reminds us all how far we've come and what more we need to accomplish. In the coming months, we'll be hosting discussions around respiratory health issues outside of COVID-19, but we'll also likely return to the issue when necessary. I also hope you enjoyed the new segment added today to highlight milestones and personalities in cardiopulmonary medicine, and look forward to those in the future. So be sure to subscribe to Lungcast on your favorite podcast platform and register on both lung.org and hcplive.com for more respiratory health news and insights. For now, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.